I'm Peggy Pirro, and this is Food From Here. Brought to you by Swirka and More, enhancing opportunities for independent living and a better quality of life for seniors in southwestern Indiana. That mission now includes an intergenerational community garden partnership with Young and Established to relieve food insecurity in our community. She grew up in the desert mountain town of Flagstaff, Arizona. He went to high school at North High in Evansville. They met in Sandpoint, Alaska, a town of about 600 residents situated on the eastern portion of the Aleutian Islands. They came back to Evansville after buying 10 acres of overgrown woodland in Posey County they found for sale online while still in Alaska. Nate and Emily Julian built a home on their land and started the farm they named Earthrise. They now grow 27 kinds of peppers, along with tomatoes and flowers. They keep goats and ducks and chickens. They cultivate mushrooms. They forage in their woodland that they're clearing of invasives little by little, planting nut trees and reviving existing stands of brambleberries. Their outlook is long-term. They do a lot of observing. We spoke at the end of August when they were taking their peppers and flowers to the New Harmony Farmers Market every week. That market continues through October on the lawn of the Working Man's Institute. And you can find their peppers and mushrooms online at Local Source. Links to all are in the show notes. After our conversation, I'll share a recipe Emily passed along for easy chili verde, so stick around for that. Now, here's Nate and Emily of Earthrise Permaculture Farm. Emily and Nate, welcome to Food From Here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's get a little background on the two of you. Can you tell us where you grew up and what kind of food you grew up with? Emily, you want to start with you?
Sure. So I grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is a really outdoorsy mountain town. It's not the typical desert that you think of in Arizona. So we naturally spent a lot of time outside, and my parents own a vet clinic. My dad's a veterinarian. My mom runs the practice. So did a lot with animals. And we ate a lot of food from the garden. We always had a garden. I ate a lot of elk. I didn't really eat much beef until I was like 30 because my parents hunted. We kept chickens for eggs and for meat. We did a lot of berry picking and foraging, prickly pear cactus fruit, mushrooms, things like that. So it was a great childhood.
It sounds it. Nate?
Yeah, so I'm from the Evansville area. I grew up on the north side of Evansville. And then when I was 18, I went into the military. So I was in the Air Force for 4 years, got out, and then went to school in Montana to be a teacher. And got a job up in Alaska, in Sandpoint, Alaska. And that's where we actually met, is up there in Alaska. And I always said, you know, if I want to move back to be closer to family, like after we had our daughter, we said it'd be easier to be closer to one of our families. I'd want to move by like the New Harmony area. So that's kind of where we started looking when my daughter was like a year old, looking to move back. But growing up, I kind of had the opposite of her. I had pretty much box food, and we'd cook things every once in a while, like special meals and stuff like that for holidays. But it wasn't a big, we weren't like a big foodie family. My parents owned a greenhouse, Julian's Roses, while I was a teenager. So they spent a lot of time working there. So we did, you know, grow stuff in the greenhouse there, along with the flowers.
So when you started looking for places to live, places to start your farm down here in Indiana, you had some familiarity then already with the lay of the land here.
Right, yeah. It's been a lot of time. My grandma used to live out in Wadesville, so spent a lot of time in that area. We'd go out to New Harmony, go camping in the park quite a bit when we were kids, and I always just liked that area. So when we had the opportunity to move back, we said, hey, let's look for some, you know, property or a house out in that area and see what we can find. But there weren't really many houses for sale at the time. And the ones that were needed a lot of work if they had any land with it. So we ended up finding that 10 acres and building our own house there.
Yeah. Sandpoint, Alaska.
Sandpoint, yeah.
Where's that?
So if you are going from Anchorage, you're going to fly about 600 miles west out into the Aleutian Islands.
Oh.
So it's very remote. It's not connected to the road system. Most of the villages in Alaska are not on the road system, correct, which a lot of people don't really realize unless they've been up there. And so, yeah, you have to fly out there, or if you're lucky, a couple times a year, you can take a ferry from Homer, which takes a couple days to get out there.
Wow.
So, yeah, the island itself has a little small town on it. When we were there, there were a little less than 1,000 people during the peak time of year in the summer. Mm-hmm. In the winter, it's a lot less than that. And we were both teaching up there at the time. I still teach. Nate's not teaching anymore, but we met up there, and it was a really good adventure.
How did you get there from Flagstaff, if I could ask?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, you know, I always loved being outdoors and nature and all of that. And my uncle was stationed up in Kodiak when I was a kid. So we got to go up to Alaska a few times and spend some time on Kodiak Island, and I just fell in love with it. And, you know, to me, Alaska's always going to be home no matter where I am. I just, that's where my heart is. So yeah. We got to go up there a few times, and I really liked it. And when I graduated from college, I was looking into teaching jobs, and Alaska treats their teachers pretty well. And I loved it there. I wanted an adventure. So that's where I started looking for jobs.
Had you considered, after you met in Alaska, had you considered buying land there?
We did. We owned a house up there. Where we were in Sandpoint, just the weather is very restrictive. It's extremely windy and rainy all year round.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
There's not many trees. It's pretty wind-blown most of the time.
Yeah, you can grow things there, but not like you can
it's
here.
It's pretty difficult.
And just getting anything that you need for building, or, you know, even things like fertilizer or, you know, anything like that. It's such an ordeal. You have to get it shipped to Seattle, put it on a barge. So cost prohibitive and just difficult that, you know, we did a little bit of gardening up there, but nothing like we could do here. We thought about maybe going to other parts of Alaska, but we really just wanted to be close to family.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you moved back here
2018.
So you've been here 6-7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We built our house.
That was finished in 2019.
Yeah. In December, we moved in January 2020, and then everything shut down.
Right.
Yeah.
So it gave us some time to really get to know the land, though, which was nice. We spent a lot of time at home for those first few months.
So even though you had, Nate, you grew up here, you had familiarity with the area here. And Emily, you were raised with critters and gardens and eating from your backyard. Still, deciding to buy a piece of land and farm it, that's a life-changing decision. Even when you're carrying the careers with you, that's still a lifestyle change and a big geographic change. I would love to know some of the conversations that you had when you were trying to decide about this change. Or were you just all gung-ho? And let's do this.
We're kind of both the sort of people who, if we have an idea, we just sort of do it.
Yeah. It's more of the gung-ho. I don't know. We'd always been kind of interested in farming. And we have lots of hobbies that kind of intersect with that. So, I don't know. We kind of just said, let's try it out and see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we started kind of with the smaller, like the mushroom part of our business, since you can do that indoors in a tent, basically. And then we got chickens and ducks and now goats.
Yeah, so since we bought the land and it had no infrastructure on it, it's taking us, you know, quite a bit of time and work to build all of that up. So we just sort of started where we could, and every year we add a little bit more.
Yeah. Now, when you say no infrastructure, do you mean water lines, electric?
Nothing. It was a field, an overgrown field. Yeah, it's got tons of invasive species all over it, plant species. And we've just been going from scratch, basically, which is good and bad. I mean, we can make it the way we want it, but it is a lot of work.
And you bought it sight unseen, basically?
Yeah, basically. We found it online, the listing, while we were up there in Alaska, and sent my parents out to check it out. My parents sent back some videos of them walking around the woods, and my dad, like I said, they used to have like a rose business, so he's done a lot of horticulture and all that, so he kind of knew what we were looking for. you know, with the wooded part, and there's a spring back there that's an old stock pond for cattle, I believe. And so it's got a lot of the stuff we were looking for, and we just said, hey, let's do it.
Yeah,
we really just kind of did as much of a deep dive as we could from Alaska.
Yeah, I got on a lot of maps. I even did like topographic maps and had found some LIDAR scans of the area that show like the different elevations and like vegetation growth and all that stuff from the state of Indiana.
Yeah.
So just doing lots and lots of research as we couldn't, you know, physically be on the land. We were doing as much background research as we could, and then with the idea of where we're going to build the house at and getting all that set up.
Yeah. So you knew you wanted a place for the house, and you needed some relatively flat land that you could garden and raise animals on.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew you wanted some wooded bits on the
land. Yeah, we wanted just kind of a mixed area.
Yeah.
Happened to find that spot because no one wants to farm it. It's got a creek running through the middle of it. There's lots of like little sinkholes and stuff in the back. I know the neighbors were looking, their friends were looking to buy it, possibly to have some horses there, but it has holes that are dangerous for horses.
Dangerous.
Lots of black locusts, which is really poisonous to horses too.
Oh, so. The tree?
Yeah, the tree, yeah.
Huh.
So basically it was open because no one else wanted the land.
So, it was waiting for you.
Yeah.
Where did you come up with the name Earthrise? And it's spelled Earth, E-A-R-T-H-R-Y-Z.
We're both big space nerds. So yeah, he's a former science teacher, and I've just always been into science and space. And so we both really like the photo from the Apollo 8 mission of the Earthrise. It's just a beautiful photo. And we kind of wanted to tie mycology into it, like, you know, the idea of, you know, mycorrhizae. So that's where we got the spelling.
I see.
Then we just kind of, you know, everything's that you grow is just sort of rising from the earth. So
yeah. When you first got there, did you think you were homesteading, or were you thinking more of making a market enterprise?
I think it was a combination of both. We've always kind of been into some aspects of like homesteading and farmsteading and permaculture. So it's kind of a nice area for us to experiment with different aspects of those things. But we also decided we wanted to do something like for market. We wanted to say, hey, let's do eggs, let's do mushrooms. That was where we kind of started our focus.
Okay.
And then we've kind of just moved on from there to market garden. And yeah.
How long did it take you to establish some of that?
So we bought the land, purchased land in 2018. It took until 2020 to have the house. And then after that, within that first year, once we moved in, we had our chickens. We had started growing mushrooms, started doing a lot of work on the woods, work around the property.
Yeah, a lot of cleanup.
Removing a lot of invasives, which is an ongoing process. And then we've just expanded from there every year.
Did you do any foraging at first with the mushrooms?
We did. Mm-hmm. One of the first things we found on the property was a lot of wild oyster mushrooms, which was kind of exciting.
Yeah.
And we've got tons of wild blackberries.
And elderberries.
Yeah, elderberries. There's quite a lot there already.
Did you come with this knowledge, specifically mushrooms?
Well, Emily's kind of the expert on that. You did a lot of foraging for mushrooms
in
Arizona.
Yeah, I did some foraging with my dad growing up. And so I knew a little bit about mushrooms. Of course, the mushrooms in the West are not exactly the same ones that we have here. So there was a lot to learn, but I was always kind of interested in it. And so we just kind of started talking more about what we were going to do, and we just both got really interested in the science behind mushrooms. And so then Nate really took the lead on that because he has a lot of science background. Mm-hmm. And that was just natural for him to start doing that. So he does all of our lab work for our mushrooms.
With the mushrooms, do you make your own blocks?
Yeah, so we start some of them from just spores.
Uh-huh.
We can take spore cultures, and I can take that all the way through the liquid culture and then the inoculation of the rye. We use rye berries or oats. Let that grow out, let the mycelium expand in that, then transfer that over to hardwood blocks, which is kind of a 50-50 mix almost of, I'd say, like hardwood pellets. Use hardwood fuel pellets and soy and wheat bran, like basically animal feed. And then we'll let that grow out and put it in the fruiting chamber and, grow them from there. We also do some where we take the rye and we'll put it onto straw instead. So like oyster mushrooms, lots of oyster varieties that grow well on pasteurized straw. And we'll grow those outside during the summer so we can kind of expand our area because our tent's not very big for the indoor one and it's really hard to keep it super clean. Yeah. So we grow like the lion's mane will grow in the tent. That's like our main indoor one that we do with that more high-tech method. And then in the winter we'll do, when we're not doing active markets and we don't have to worry about timing and all that, we'll do shiitakes and reishis because they take quite a bit longer to produce a crop.
Yeah, and we found we don't want shiitakes in the tent when we have anything else in there because they're messy.
So we do that in the winter when we don't have anything else going on.
Tell me a little bit about your garden and maybe about the workflow on your farm. Who does what?
So I start everything pretty much that we grow from seed. We very rarely buy anything that's already started with the exception of a few native plants. But I start our whole market garden from seed and then most of the native plants that we're growing I start from seed. And then I do all of the packaging and design work for our labels, things like that, along with anything that we post on social media, market setup, a lot of that stuff, you know, I kind of take the lead on. And then Nate does a lot of the mushroom work. He does all our lab work. He does pretty much everything with growing the mushrooms. He does a lot of work around the woods, the property. He kind of manages all of the land. And then he does everything with our bees. I don't do anything with the bees. Yeah, I want to. I just haven't gotten into it yet.
Right.
But yeah, we have chickens, ducks, bees. We have Nigerian dwarf goats. We've got our dogs, of course. And then in the market garden, I'm growing 27 different kinds of chilies this year. Tomatoes, herbs, tomatillos, cucumbers. We've got 5 kinds of mushrooms. Berries. I'm starting to really get into cut flowers. We're doing some kind of cool stuff with native plants and trying to kind of manage the invasives. I'll let Nate talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so when we moved the property, it was basically completely overgrown. Lots of, it's called Japanese chaff weed. It almost looks like when it's young, it almost looks like a young dogwood tree or something like that, but it grows rapidly.
I know the plant you're talking
about.
Yeah,
and then it puts out those little spikes that stick on everything, and it grows into basically a mesh that you can't walk through if you let it go too far. So that's all through our woods, and we've just been taking chunks of that out at a time. It's part of the reason we got the goats is to help manage some of that.
Goats are amazing.
They love that stuff too. Mm-hmm. So we're getting them out in the woods and getting them trained to eat up some of those patches before they get out of control. And we also had a lot of calorie pears, Bradford pears.
Oh.
And I've been involved with Posey County Invasive program there where it helps. They go down the highway and help remove some of those. You'll see them in the spring where they have the white flowers, and it's not the best smell, to put it mildly. Yeah. But we've had quite a few of those, and then I looked into is it possible to maybe graft onto these, because I was reading that they'd actually use those for rootstock for pear trees down in the southern United States originally, and for erosion control, stuff like that. So I started just experimenting on them, basically.
Uh-huh.
And we took Asian pear grafts and basically take the top off of the calorie pear, and then put in some scion wood from Asian pear varieties and just let it go and see what happened. And we actually had pears our second year off of those trees. Since the rootstocks are so much bigger and vigorous, it just went crazy. So now we've started grafting all of those that I find on the property. We'll have a new one pop up here and there everywhere, and I'll just graft onto them. So we're kind of starting our orchard
wherever those invasive pears pop up.
Yeah.
How many trees are we talking about here that you think on 10 acres? Is it hundreds or is it dozens?
I would say the pear trees, we've probably got about 20 of them grafted now. And yeah, they just keep popping up like literally weeds. So as I find them, I'll mark them. And then when it's time to graft in the spring, I'll go back and hit them with that. But yeah, I would say our property is what, like, I would say half wooded. We've got some tall native grasses in the front, some fields that we're trying to keep clear of getting overrun by trees, because we do have like the good warm season native grasses there, the big blue stem, the little blue stem.
Oh, nice.
So that's the animals love it. And we kind of do attract wildlife to our property. But we want to keep those free, so we'll burn that every 3 years. We'll actually just go through, and I'll take it down with a brush hog. And once it's dried out, we'll burn that off so it kills off any of the trees and invasive stuff that's in there. Like the honeysuckle's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
It smells better than the pears, though.
It does. It smells much better than the pears, yeah. And then the rest of it, it's about, I don't know, the middle section, I would say, where the creek runs through is pretty heavily wooded. We've got some older trees that were never cut down because they're too hard to get to. Black walnuts, pecans, some cottonwood trees, and a lot of cherry trees, too. And then the back part, we've got a lot of brambles. We've got one corner that was just completely overgrown with blackberries, but we've taken and burning and scything and... brush hogging it down to where it's manageable now, and it's regrowing back because it was so overgrown that light couldn't reach the
right,
and you weren't getting much fruit off of it before, but now it's coming back pretty strong, and we're putting pathways through that so that we can, you know, actually get in there and pick berries when it's time. And then we've got another little section in the back that's also got a bunch of native grasses that's going to eventually become an orchard. So
a fruit orchard?
Yeah, orchard.
Nice. Because you've got some nut trees then.
We do, yeah. Colors. We have some nut trees, and we've planted quite a few. I just put in 100 hazelnut trees last year. But yeah, we'll just go through and plant to have a little bit more diversity. Like with the, especially with like pecans, edible nuts.
Yeah.
And we planted trees. A lot of pawpaws.
Pawpaws, persimmons. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Tell me about the pawpaws, because my experience with pawpaws is that you have to pick them and eat them very quickly because they don't hold. They lose their sweetness. They lose the enticing aroma. What is your experience with pawpaws?
Basically that. Yeah. They're like... day or next day,
right,
maybe. Yeah.
There's a reason you don't find them in grocery stores.
Yeah, you can't ship them. So, yeah. But yeah, they are delicious, and we're trying to get quite a few more established back in the woods there. They make a good understory tree. So you've got your nut trees that are in the canopy, and then you've got a lot of understory trees like the service berries and the pawpaws and the hazelnuts that you can come in with that at the lower level. And then you've got your ground cover as well. So you've basically got three layers of producing food instead of just like a regular garden would be.
And then, of course, there's the wild mushrooms that might grow as well.
And that's one of the things we did find out was the black locust is terrible for mushroom growth. It has natural anti-mycology properties. So.
Oh, yeah, natural antifungals.
Yeah, antifungals, yeah. So... But they do make excellent fence posts because of that. So we've actually got a stand that we're managing now that will become the fence post for our property once we expand out to put goats back into that wooded section. We're kind of growing our fence post while we're, you know, waiting for other things to get established.
Tell me about the water source. Did you call it a creek or a stream?
Yeah, it's a small stream that kind of runs through the middle of the property.
How's the water?
It's mostly runoff. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's good. There's not. It's more of a seasonal right now. We do have that spring back there. There's an old stock pond that's mostly filled in now, but there is a spring that goes year round from the local area there. So we'll eventually get that dug back out and then use that water resource to help, you know, water the back parts of the property, the berry bushes and the orchard area. That's the plan, at least.
Let's talk a little bit about permaculture and regenerative farming. Can you give us a refresher course on what those terms mean?
Yeah, so permaculture is it's basically a system where you try and grow more perennial crops instead of annual crops. And you want a diversity of crops as well. You don't want a monoculture. So you're not just growing a field of corn. You're growing a field that involves, like I said, you've got the different layers, and like the food forest. You've got your nut trees that provide the canopy. You've got your understory trees. And then you've got herbs and stuff down on the ground level. So you're kind of taking, instead of trying to force the land to do what you're trying to get to, you're kind of doing the opposite. You're letting the land kind of show you exactly what will grow there on its own. You do a lot of observation. It's mostly planning. We've just planned, like, watch, see what the land does, see what grows there, and then make plans based off of that. And you've kind of got your zones of control, they call them, where you've got your house. And then as you go out from there, it gets a little bit more and more wild. So you've got areas of the property where you kind of just let go to see what happens there naturally, and leave it for wildlife. And as you get closer to the house, you get more use out of certain areas. And it's about building like plant guilds and groupings of plants that work well together.
Plant guilds.
Yeah.
That's a new phrase to me.
Yeah. We've got a family of plants that all kind of interact together or provide benefits. So you've got, they'll attract pollinators, they'll attract wasps that will eat some of the pests in the garden. So you're kind of working with the native plants, and even some of the weeds will leave some areas even around the garden just to get a little weedy, because we found that like the June bugs, instead of attacking our garden, they found a weed that grows and they'll go crazy
on
that.
That one just as well.
It takes them right off of our plants.
We've been pretty intentional with integrating everything we do together. We don't really have anything in isolation. So we have native plant plantings throughout our market garden, which attract a lot of native pollinators. We'll rotationally graze the goats and our chickens and ducks through different areas. And just, you know, our management practices like burning and things like that, we don't have to spray anything because we haven't had any pest problems, really.
Not really.
So it works really well.
And then when we do notice a pest problem, we're like, well, okay, so why is that attacking this plant? Why is there an overabundance of that kind of, you know, pest, insect?
Yes. Something's out of balance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you clues to what might be out of balance, and then you can plan off of that. Like I said, it's a lot of observation. And then for the restorative agriculture, it's just, instead of, you know, taking all the resources off the land, you're trying to put it back, use just what you need, and then build back essentially what you take away. So we're, you know, building up the soil. Our soil is not the best. It's kind of through that creek area, lots of clay. So as we build in organic material into that, we loosen it up and kind of build the little microenvironment of the soil so that it supports what we're trying to grow better.
Yeah. Your first thought can't be, what can I take from the land? Your first thought has to be, what can I give back to it first? Before you can take anything, you have to put something in. It's kind of that idea of the honorable harvest, like, you know, not taking more than you need and not taking things in a way that's going to harm the ecosystem.
Yeah, I like that phrase, honorable harvest. When I was looking into your farm, I was reminded of the writings of Wendell Berry, of course. He's been writing about stewardship for decades. Have you read any of Wendell Berry?
Yeah, we've read some. And he does talk a lot about, you know, kind of the unsettling of America.
That's the era that I first was introduced to him.
That's my favorite of his work, I'd say, yeah. For sure. But we research lots and lots. So we've got a lot of different authors that kind of are on that same mindset.
Can you share some of those?
Yeah.
I would say my biggest influence has been Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's amazing. So she's a Potawatomi botanist. So she talks a lot about the integration of science and indigenous knowledge and how those are not mutually exclusive things. And I feel like that's really important because a lot of what we call permaculture is truly just indigenous knowledge that's being renamed. And so I feel like it's super important to give indigenous people a voice and listen to indigenous people in this space. And her books, Braiding Sweetgrass, Gathering Moss, she has another one coming out this fall, are just amazing. Like, everyone should read them. And her audiobooks are great. She does the narration, and it's they're like soothing.
She came into town last year.
She did. We got to meet her. Yeah, we got to meet her. It was
so inspiring. Yeah, he just wanted to talk more. Please talk more. Yeah. Anybody else that comes to mind as influences?
I mean, you got like the permaculture, the original permaculture people like Bill Mollison and all those. But yeah, I mean, there's such a wide variety. We kind of just pick pieces from here and there, mm-hmm. what seems to work for us. So, yeah.
And I would say some of our life experiences have been a big influence too. Like, for example, up in Alaska, a lot of people still live a traditional subsistence lifestyle. So when we were up there, we were just surrounded by hunting and fishing and berry picking, and you know, people are traditionally very respectful of the land because you can only take so much before you're not going to get anything back. And so that's just been an influence as well, just, you know, the way I grew up and our experiences living in Alaska and things of that nature.
Yeah, for sure.
I wanted to ask you about your experience with the New Harmony Farmers Market, how that's going for you.
We love the New Harmony Farmers Market.
Yeah.
It's not the biggest market in the area, but it's for its size, it's great. We have a lot of variety. We have several produce vendors. There's some really great artisans. We have live music. It's a great environment. And so we just kind of wanted to get involved with a market that was close to home.
And fairly small to begin with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We don't really know what we're doing for a lot of the time, but, you know.
Yeah, we're learning as we go. Yeah. And we just wanted to support kind of our hometown market and help it grow. And it's been great.
How many seasons have you been at the market?
This is our second, yeah. And we'll definitely be back again next year.
Are you selling anywhere else?
We are on Local Source as well.
We've got some gaps in our local food system. Just connecting the farm with the customer can be challenging. Have you experienced any of that difficulty in trying to find buyers or trying to get your product to people who would be happy to receive it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people just don't know that it's there. Yeah. When people find out about local food, local small farms, they get really excited about it, but it's not always very well known that we're there. Like, we found a lot of people don't know that New Harmony has a farmers market. And so just getting the word out is a big thing, and getting people to try new things. A lot of what we grow is stuff we personally like. You know, we grow what we want to eat. So I grew up in Arizona, so I have a love of chili peppers. So that's why I grow so many different kinds. And, you know, sometimes people are kind of scared to try something new, and once they try it, they usually come back and they're like, oh, that was so good. I made, you know, this with it. And so just kind of getting the word out and getting people to try new things.
Do you grow enough to serve any of the local ethnic markets?
We don't yet. That's definitely kind of something we'd like to get into.
One of the plans for the future, for sure. Yeah. That, and we are going to start our farm stand. I'm going to get that built this fall. So we will be able to just provide food directly from the farm. And then, like you said, Local Source, we've gotten into that this year. So that's been kind of challenging to figure out the schedule and all that.
Yeah, but the logistics of it.
Yeah, the logistics of it. But sure. I think it's going to be really good for the future for us to find buyers for what we're producing. And like you said, we really grow mostly stuff that we'll eat anyhow. So
that makes sense.
We've got our own food supply, at least, if nobody else wants to buy it.
We couldn't find the kind of chilies that I like to use when I cook when we moved here. So I just started growing them kind of expanded from there into more and more kinds.
You. Yeah, I would think that there would be a market for that once people know it's available. Getting, as you said, getting the word out and expanding people's concept of what's available beyond what they see in the grocery store.
Right.
That is an ongoing challenge and opportunity. And step by step, and it's a slow process just like anything else.
For sure.
Yeah.
And even just finding like supplies for a small farm, you know, like sourcing our substrate and all that's for the mushrooms. That's been probably the most challenging part, is finding companies that'll sell in smaller amounts.
Yeah.
You know, every farm back 100 years ago was a small farm, basically. So we've moved so far away from that now. I think people are starting to go back in the other direction. So hopefully we can find a balance between the two. And like you said, a little bit better distribution networks for local food, local suppliers for what you need on a small farm.
And getting people to think differently about the way they shop, too. Just kind of get people to think different and
the seasonality
realize what's out there. Yeah. Seasonal eating is also a big thing.
When you get strawberries in the middle of winter, those strawberries are not grown in this hemisphere. So they came from a long way away, and they're probably not the best quality.
They're going to be pale inside and crunchy.
They will be.
Well, let me ask you what you would like to see happen on your farm, say, over the next 10 years.
Well, a lot of the crops and plants we're planting now do take a longer time to establish. So with the perennial crops, that's the trade-off. You're not getting something right away. You have to wait for it. You have to let it establish. You have to keep it cleared off and pruned and everything like that. So it takes a while to establish. So I think in 10 years, the things we've been planting since we moved there will really start to produce.
Have a lot less invasives and, you know, trees that are not really benefiting the ecosystem, have more trees that are really beneficial.
Yeah, that bring in, you like oak trees that bring in just tons of different kinds of insects and other kinds of wildlife that are, you know, good to see on the property and show you that the land is kind of healing itself, instead of just being, you know, an old area where it was a stock pond and there was a dump part back in part of the woods. We found old tires and stuff like that. I mean, it was just a piece of trash land that, you know, we're trying to bring back to what it could be before it was just trashed.
Do you still consider yourselves beginning farmers, or are you feeling more in the journeyman stage?
A little bit of both.
Yeah, I would say
depends
right
what area of farming. Some areas I feel like we're pretty solid in, and then there's a lot that we're still learning. So, right.
And then just like the basics of like the business side of it and all that. Neither one of us really has a business background. Learning all that from scratch has been intimidating. But
one of the things that is apparent to me is the need for mentorship, the bringing up of new farmers, whether they're young or career changers or whatever, people who just want to learn and grow, maybe even not for market, but for themselves, to develop a different kind of relationship with the land that they live on. And sometimes people who are only 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years out in their journey make better mentors than people who are 20 years at it, because you're closer to those experiences that the brand new farmers are going to encounter.
Right.
So I would encourage a little of that.
For sure.
Both and, teachers and
we've
and
had
so, good
so many people in the community have just been so welcoming to us.
Yeah.
You know, Roger and Mary Winstead have been just so kind and, you know, helping us wherever they can with whatever. And, you know, Kathy Yearwood comes to mind just as being someone who's so welcoming. And
yeah, the community is just, pretty good,
just,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, there's so many people that have just been so welcoming, so it's great.
Yeah, and then also with building local source, they're kind of building that network of mentors and, you know, other producers, so people can kind of find each other, because sometimes it's just hard to find people that are doing something similar to what you're doing. They're building that network out, and that's a big benefit as well.
Yeah, and it takes time. It takes time away from your families, and it takes effort, and you've got to put your creativity into it. But, you know, I mean, we do a little of it, and then we go back to what we were doing, you know, with the animals or the garden.
And then sometimes you just need to take a break and go walk around the farm and just watch what, you know, where it's come from, and you kind of just see where you're at then and realize that, hey, it's starting to work, you know. The things we're doing are starting to make a little bit of a difference here, and we can see it. And just listen to the birds and the insects and everything else that's living on that land, and just relax.
Oh, I love that. That's a perfect place to stop. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to me today.
Yeah,
well, thanks
thank
for having
you.
Us.
Food From Here is sponsored by Swirka and More, working to enhance the lives of seniors in southwestern Indiana to promote independent living and a better quality of life through programs like their Intergenerational Community Garden Partnership with Young and Established. You'll find a link to Swirka in the show notes. Emily brought a basket of peppers when she and Nate came to record our conversation, and I've been enjoying them in my burritos. She also shared a recipe for chili verde that she grew up eating in Arizona. Here's how you can make it. If you can, get fresh chilies and choose an assortment. Roast about a pound of them on the grill or under the oven broiler until the skins are blistered. Put them in a container with a lid and let them steam until they're cooled. Then remove the charred skins, the stems, and the seeds if you like. You can use them right away at this point or freeze them for later use. If you can't find fresh, substitute a 14-ounce can of green chilies. For the chili verde, you'll want to heat a couple tablespoons of olive oil in a skillet. Add 2.5 to 3 pounds of lean pork that you've cut into cubes and trimmed of fat. Dice a large onion, put that in the skillet with the pork, and season it with a nice pinch of salt and pepper. When the pork is no longer pink on the outside, add your chilies, a 20-ounce can of Rotel diced tomatoes, 3 or 4 cans of pinto beans, and however much chili powder you like, starting with a couple teaspoons and going from there. Add 3 cups of hot water, put a lid on it, and simmer it until the meat is tender, maybe 30 minutes or so. Serve it with shredded cheese and whatever toppings you like. There are a lot of complicated chili verde recipes out there. This one is simple and doable in under an hour. You'll find it written out in the show notes. And that's the show for today. Look for Earthrise Permaculture Farm on the Local Source website and on Facebook. And join me in 2 weeks for a conversation with Purdue Extension's Amanda Bradshaw-Burks when we talk about urban agriculture and 4-H. If you have a question or would like to suggest a guest or a topic for Food From Here, send me an email, foodfromhere@wnin.org. Food From Here is produced by Tri-State Media in downtown Evansville, home of WNIN-FM and WNIN-PBS. Thanks to Swirka and More for their sponsorship and to you for your support of public media. I'm Peggy Pirro. We'll talk again soon.